argument from Beaumont Bank versus Bullard. We've allotted 15 minutes for each side to present the oral argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Mr. William B. Allison may present an argument for petition.
May it please the court, Bill Allison on behalf of Beaumont Bank and the FDIC. This case arose out of a turnover order to the district court after evidentiary hearing ordered Mrs. Buller to turn over approximately $100,000 in cash in partial satisfaction of a debt the bank had against her late husband's estate, for which she was the legal representative. The Court of Appeals, in a one-paragraph section of its opinion, reversed the turnover order on the basis of its finding that there was no evidence that there was an asset owned by the estate that was the subject of the turnover. In other words, the $100,000 cash. As I read that order, they held that the bank had not sufficiently traced the asset from the admitted possession of Mrs. Buller and her attorney and his trust account into the admitted fund in the Cayman Islands that she held that was in excess of $100,000 in cash. I would like to address 2 points with the court today. The first being whether the motion for rehearing sufficiently preserved all of the arguments that we presented in our brief today because of numerous challenges in the brief of the respondent to the procedural presentation of those arguments. And secondly, whether this case, despite anything that may be excluded regarding the partial nature of the record below, still is a proper case, in fact, cries out for the turnover relief because of the unique nature of the facts in this case involving a fund of cash that was traced into the hands of the fiduciary, where she admits that the purpose of this smokescreen of transfers through attorney's account were for the purpose of getting the money beyond the reach of the bank, and where you can infer from the circumstances that, in fact, money remained in her possession. On the question that they have raised regarding the argument presented to this court that it was only a partial record below, and therefore this court, under its precedent most recently applied in the Christensen case early this year, should not allow the Court of Appeals on a partial record to find on no evidence basis.
What about the respondent's contention that the judgment itself and all of the record shows that the part of the record omitted played no part in the evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the problem with that contention is that it is factually incorrect, and it is also legally impermissible to draw that inference. First of all, as to the facts, he asserts that the bank accepted and adopted the complete record and various arguments along those lines. And that is contrary to the facts. The Court of Appeals, in its opinion, recognized that they had before it a partial record. They state on page 3 of the opinion that the hearing began on January 7th, and that was very important to their opinion because in another point of error, not important on these issues, but regarding his right to trial by jury, they had informed the question of whether they had timely filed their jury demand and timely paid the jury fee. And so the issue of when the hearing began was recognized by the Court of Appeals and was relevant to it. And all parties, both the bank and Mrs. Buller, in their briefs to the Court of Appeals, stated that the hearing began on January 7th and was continued and concluded on February 8th. And that is, there's reference to that in the record that we have from the hearing. There's continually referring back to what happened on January 7th. And there was a very important order entered on January 7th, and that is the order that Mrs. Buller and her counsel produce all records. We don't have that order in the record before this court, so we can't really say that nothing happened that was of significance at that hearing because we don't have the record of the hearing. It would be going outside the record to ascertain what happened. If we were to go outside the record, we'd find that there was evidence taken at that hearing and Mr. Ray testified. But putting that aside, because it is outside the record, that's the exact problem. And that's why it's important under our point of error that the court improperly raised no evidence, improperly found no evidence to support the turnover order, that we look at exactly what was and what was not in the record before the Court of Appeals. And that's the argument that we've brought forward to this court, is that under the proper standard of review and under the proper analysis of no evidence point, you have to review the entire record. And basically, it seems to me that the argument raised by Mrs. Buller is that the argument brought before this court is not the identical argument that was made in the motion for rehearing. And therefore, you can't make that argument to this court. You can't argue about the standard of review, and you can't argue about the incomplete record, because you didn't argue that in your motion for rehearing. But of course, argument is not an essential part of the motion for rehearing. The rules, Appellate Rule 100 and Appellate Rule 131 do not even provide for briefing or argument in the motion for rehearing. They provide only for the statement of the point. And this court in Albright versus the City of Houston in 1984 had before it a document entitled Motion for Rehearing that contained argument and authorities but contained no points. And this court held that was the equivalent of no motion for rehearing at all. Now, that may not be the decision in the post Poole versus Ford Motor Company, but at least it indicates that the argument is superfluous to the motion for rehearing. It is the points that are set out that is the important part and that preserves the error. And the point in this case is that the no evidence ruling by the court was improper because it was supported by proper evidence. That's the point we're here on today, and that's the point that was made in the motion for rehearing. It is true that we did not argue all of the points set out in the lengthy and eloquent dissenting opinion in the Court of Appeals, and it's perhaps understandable that counsel, having seen those arguments fall on deaf ears, the majority did not choose to repeat them all in his motion for rehearing, since he had just lost on those issues, but instead, in the argument phase of the motion for rehearing, tried to focus on the evidence in a different spin on it to try and catch the court's attention in a different way than what the majority had just rejected. But nevertheless, the argument doesn't restrict the point. It doesn't restrict us from coming forward and discussing with the court the standard of review and the partial nature of the record, which is undisputed. It was noted in the majority opinion, as I said. It was noted in the dissent, and it was stated in all of the parties' briefs that the hearing began on the 7th and was continued and concluded on February 8th. And that when we review the evidence that is in the record, even setting aside from it the fact that we don't know what happened on January 7th, other than from the record we have before us, we know that an order was entered requiring records to be produced. And the importance of that, of course, is, as I mentioned, if the court, in fact, ordered records from the Cayman Island bank accounts to be produced, then the fact that those records were not produced after a recess for the purpose of gathering those records allows the district judge, as a fact finder, to draw an adverse inference, because it strains credibility to believe that anyone who has over $100,000 in an active bank account would not have some records of those funds, where those funds came from. But Mrs. Buller chose not to come forward with any evidence about those funds, and from that the district court can draw the adverse inference that in fact those records would reveal exactly what we contend, which is that that money, through this money laundering scheme of putting it through her attorney's trust account, ended up in her possession in the Cayman Islands. And really this is somewhat of a unique case because it involves property that is fungible. It involves cash that you can't easily trace. And it involves bank transactions that are, by Mrs. Buller's own admission, intended to put that cash beyond the reach of the bank, and which it has to date effectively done. So that if the court does not allow the turnover statute to be applied in this case, the Court of Appeals opinion will in effect be a blueprint for people faced with a turnover order of how to defeat it. What you do is you set up an account, you don't keep any records, or you destroy the records, or you say you don't have any records, and you stonewall. And when they ask you where the money is now, you say, I spent it. And that's a complete shield to any turnover relief, no matter how unbelievable the denials might be, and no matter how many times the court might order you to produce other bank records from the Cayman Islands and you might refuse, you would be entirely insulated from any liability for the just debts of the bank.
Does the amendment of the turnover statute in the last regular session of the legislature impact on this case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm unaware of the exact terms of that amendment. I would think that we would be under the turnover order at the time that this judgment was entered, and I'm unaware that it was amended intending to have retroactive effect back to that time. But I'd be happy to take a look at that if I have any cogent comments provided to the court.
Cash is not covered under the term proceeds under the property code. Is that correct?
Again, Your Honor, I'm not an expert on the property code, and I don't know whether, if you had a situation where you had a 1988 Cadillac that was sold and converted to cash and proceeds, that you could then follow those proceeds. But this is not that case. This is a case where it started out with cash and always has been cash. And it's not the case of having some identifiable property turned into cash and then trying to trace the proceeds. So to that extent, I don't know if that's helpful to your question. But I think that would be a more difficult question. Were we trying to say that she had converted identifiable property into cash and then had kept the cash over on one side? That might be a more difficult tracing question. But in this case, we are dealing with cash. We're dealing with a fiduciary where the representative of the estate is a fiduciary with regard to the creditors of the estate. And it's undoubted that we trace the money into the hands of the fiduciary and that she is unable to account for any proper use of the money. In fact, she states that she spent it on herself personally. And at one time she says, early in the testimony, she tries to say that's because my husband didn't have insurance, I didn't had bills to pay, I had to get on with my life. Then when it turns out that she actually has, and she admits that she has more than $100,000 in the Cayman Islands, she changes her story and tries to say, oh, well, that was my insurance money. There was insurance around. There was other money I could have used. Of course, the fact finder, the district judge, is not required to credit that newly created story that she came up with, especially in light of his comments about her demeanor at the time she was giving that very testimony in his court. So based on the rather unique fact situation that we have in this case, it would clearly, I think, be an error to allow the turnover statute to be so easily defeated in that situation. I think it would be different if he had more identifiable property. It would be different if she had a 1987 Cadillac and the estate had a 1990 Ford. If she sold the Ford, we might not be able to get her Cadillac. But in this case, it's cash. She wants to say, well, I spent your cash. My cash is still here. And generally, fiduciaries are not allowed to do that. And so that is our backup argument in case we didn't properly trace the money to the Cayman Islands, which we believe that on the evidence and with the presumptions based on the partial record, that we did properly trace it as far as was possible. And taking all inferences in favor of the bank, then I think that would be the case.
I wonder if I could trouble you to submit a supplemental brief following argument on the effect of the amendment on this case.
I would be happy to do so, Your Honor, and I appreciate that.
Can you do that in, well, we'll take the longer break, and if there's no real hurry, the next several weeks.
Okay, that'll be no problem, Your Honor. And that is, I take it on the effect of the amendment of the turnover statute.
Right. That's right. In this case.
Yes, sir. I'll be happy to do so.
Any other questions?
Your Honor, I think that this is a case that is properly under the turnover statute because of the unique facts. It is a case where the Court of Appeals recognized that it had a imperfect record, an incomplete record, and the nevertheless ruled there was no evidence.
Thank you, counsel. The Court is ready to hear oral argument. From respondent.
May it please the Court, Mr. C. Marshall Ray will present argument for respondent.
Counsel, will you agree that your client was the trustee with respect to the creditors of the estate?
Yes, sir. I have no question about that, Your Honor.
Why did you allow your personal trust account to be used in such a manner?
Your Honor, if the chronology, I could point out the salient facts here. The transaction of which you're speaking took place in December of 1985, 2 months after Mr. Buller died, 7 months before the bank had a judgment against the estate. Mrs. Buller had, through attorney Sidney King in Beaumont, filed the will for probate and was appointed independent executrix. The transaction involving the money at the bank was strictly that, a trust transaction, and the bank was informed of that during the settlement negotiations in December of 1985. There was total disclosure. The funds were not in Lumberton. The funds were in Houston in my trust account.
Did you notify the bank that you had,
yes, sir,
subject to her instructions, pulled out money to pay her daughter $10,000 when she admitted she owed her daughter no debt? And her daughter was not a creditor of the estate?
No, sir. At the point that those funds were put into my trust account, there was a dispute and there were ongoing settlement negotiations between the estate and the bank over whether to settle this case because it involved two other brothers of the decedent who were on these corporate guarantees that formed the basis for the bank's judgment against the estate and these other two parties.
Is it undisputed that the daughter was not a creditor of the estate?
I don't believe there's any dispute over that, Your Honor.
But you issued a check for $10,000 payable to the daughter?
Yes, Your Honor. At that point, I was an attorney, not the attorney for the estate, just the attorney for her, who received funds and returned funds based upon the instructions of the person who owned the funds. I was not representing the estate at that time. I was simply handling the funds. And the fact that the funds had come
on...
Sir?
What would you call that position?
Vis-a-vis Mrs. Buller, it was a trust relationship. I was holding money over which she held control. Vis-a-vis the bank, I don't think that I had a direct duty to the bank. I could not have said to her, I cannot return your money or disperse it under your instructions.
Do you think a lawyer should use his personal trust account for transactions like this?
Well, Your Honor, at the time, there was not a judgment, and there was a legitimate dispute about whether or not the bank would be even entitled to a judgment at that time. Did
your client deny that, first of all, that she had any life insurance proceeds or there were any proceeds?
She may have. I'm trusting counsel properly quoted the record. The life insurance issue, this, by the way, was 20 months after the judgment. There had been a lot of other post-judgment matters here that are not a record here on discovery.
Did you tell her that she was under an obligation to furnish the records the court ordered her to?
Yes, sir.
Did she furnish those records?
No, sir. I furnished every record that I had with regard to the disposition of any of her funds that came under my control.
But she furnished no records?
No, sir, she didn't.
As an experienced attorney, is it easy to reach funds in the Cayman Islands and bank accounts there?
No, sir. Now, those were proceeds from her husband's life insurance policy. I mean, those were clearly her separate property. We were not involved here in a suit against a fiduciary for misapplication of estate funds. We were here on a turnover proceeding over someone who was alleged to be in possession of estate property.
She admittedly took the estate property, transferred it to avoid creditor having a chance to recover based upon that property, and then spent the estate funds. Is there any dispute as to that?
Well, sir, it's not, if you examine the record, the purposes for which that money was set, to the extent that it was in my control, there's a schedule in the record showing where every, pursuant to instructions from her, some of them went to pay house mortgages. We'd argued that this was a legitimate part of a widow's allowance, even though this is an independent administration. There was no dispute over that. Those funds were gone.
She spent $17,000. There was no dispute that was not to pay a creditor.
No, sir. Her testimony is she was trying to keep her husband's used car business afloat. Her children were working with her. I mean, at the time that I was given the instructions to turn the funds over to her, it was not... From my perspective, it was returning funds to her that were hers. I didn't think I had the right to tell to her. I did not instruct her or advise her how to handle her funds.
Did she cooperate with the court in any manner?
I think the record shows that Mrs. Buller was not cooperative with the court. She was very intimidated by the entire process and over the judgment by the bank.
Isn't this what the turnover statute was meant to reach? In other words, assets that were available and subject to execution but were simply hard to reach.
You have to define the term assets. The turnover statute involves assets of the estate. Counsel for the bank, or the FDIC, a successor to the bank, has argued that they traced funds to an offshore account, and there was no tracing whatsoever. These were clearly, under the record, life insurance proceeds. There was no tracing of the disbursement that came out of my trust account into her and then over to there. That's an inference they draw. At the trial court level, and in the briefs, some of which are part of this record, it was argued that those were her separate property. The problem we face here, Your Honor, and the questions you raise, I think, are pertinent.
When did she first said that there was no life insurance? Isn't that right?
He referenced a part of the record where she... No, there was never in the record any doubt that Mrs. Buller had cash proceeds of her own from life insurance. In her testimony, she was testimony by needing money to take care of herself, and I believe in a part of the record, she had first denied she had life insurance proceeds, but this
but
entire
that
case...
That was early in the proceeds. Was it the same time that later on she changed her testimony to say that she had some proceeds of the life insurance policy in the bank and came out?
And we're all talking about all an occurrence within the same hearing, not
yes,
something that
yes.
occurred over... There was always the big issue over the issue of the whereabouts of her insurance proceeds, which were not part of the estate and were not scheduled in the estate.
But then did she admit that they were in the Cayman Islands?
She admitted that she put funds offshore, yes, sir.
Was that her
offshore? Are you using
no,
that to mean Cayman Islands?
Yes, sir.
Aren't the words Cayman Islands in the record?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so she admitted that there were funds in the Cayman Islands.
Yes, sir. She admitted that her life insurance proceeds from the death of her husband she put offshore.
In the Cayman Islands?
Yes, sir.
Well, what's the difference between offshore and Cayman Islands?
Oh, I mean, they were outside of Texas, the outside of the jurisdiction of Texas. But those were, the focus of the entire hearing was over the proceeds of the $100,000 CD at Lumberton Bank. The bank, except for producing a testimony under objection regarding her life insurance proceeds, the funds that were involved here involved the disposition and tracing of funds out of Lumberton, Texas. And many of those dispositions were directly to other parties. The court was dissatisfied over the accounting for those funds. From my own standpoint, I was quite concerned over accounting for every dollar that had come through my control. And the problem we had is that the bank was there to enforce turnover of funds that were owned by the estate. Mrs. Buller was not there as a judgment debtor. It's been 4 years since the judgment. She has never been made a judgment debtor. This was not a proceeding for an accounting by a fiduciary under the probate code. It was the use of a procedural turnover device to simply secure specific funds. The distinction between this and virtually every other turnover decision that I've read is that they've always involved a discrete asset, whether it's the corpus of a trust, like in the Beaumont versus Phelan case, or whether it's a note, or whether it's stock, like in the Norsell decision. There's always an asset that everybody acknowledges exists. The bank went in on the premise. It was called the fungible goods theory. She's being a fiduciary, has to account for this money. She hasn't accounted for it. We're not going to go to the probate court and order an accounting as allowed under the code. We're not going to file a suit against her and seek personal judgment and go after her personal assets. We believe if she does not give a satisfactory accounting of the fund here in this turnover proceeding, if there is evidence she has control of any other funds, we may order her to produce it. I think it's fair to say from the record that the trial court was quite upset with Mrs. Buller.
Counsel, isn't that because they said you are ordered to bring in the records of what happened to the $100,000, and she showed up at the hearing with one sheet of paper, and that's it?
Yes, sir. I think that the trial judge was very disturbed over that, and frankly, so was her counsel. I was disturbed over it. But all I could do, having been named as part of the turnover proceeding, was simply account for the funds as they were when they were in my control. And some of those funds went to sources, like for a mortgage payment, which are legitimate expenditures out of an estate. But that argument didn't pass muster with the trial court. I believe that the trial court's reaction to Mrs. Buller's handling of the fund was that, well, we know she has some money somewhere. We're going to order her to turn this over. We're not happy with her accounting. The problem is Ms. Buller is not individually a judgment debtor, and the bank never presented these assets as part of the estate. In the record, it's not part of the estate.
The record shows that virtually all of the $100,000 was unaccounted for. Let me ask you this question. Counsel, if a person is allowed to pursue the course of action, which she did, doesn't that just totally thwart the power of a trial court to order someone appearing before it to do anything?
Your Honor, the equities of the case that the court is focusing on here, I understand where the focus is coming from. I've lived through this. But we still are a system of laws, and what the bank chose to do is not go after Mrs. Buller personally, not seek a judgment against her as a fiduciary, not seek to trace and find and secure turnover over her separate estate. They went straight to the turnover device and simply...
I'm talking about the power of a court. When someone appears before it and they're subject to its jurisdiction, she thwarted the court and ignored every one of its orders and its instructions totally, except for one sheet of paper. And then she lied on the record about other facets of the case. Now, if that is to be countenanced, what are the courts to do in future cases?
I think it behooves the judgment creditor to bring that party in under the proper substantive law, not to use the turnover device as a short circuit to getting around the substantive issues. There are other equities here. This was a non-jury turnover proceeding. It wasn't intended to be a development of what she could and could not do with her funds. Mrs. Buller had exposure to being accountable for the use of these funds. There's no question about that. But the bank chose to approach it by simply filing a turnover proceeding and simply being able to show that because she had control of some funds somewhere that were not part of the estate and were never argued to be part of the estate, but because she had control over it, the court could order to produce them because she didn't account. But this was not a procedure for an accounting by a fiduciary. It was a search for specific discrete assets to apply toward the bank's judgment against the estate. I'm not before this body attempting to argue the wisdom or the propriety of the conduct of the executrix. I certainly would like the court to appreciate my position before there was a judgment, while negotiations were going on. My limited control over those funds was fully disclosed to the bank, and that appears in the record. The bank at that time, I suppose, could have chosen to do a prejudgment attachment because it took a number of months before these were dispersed, but I don't think I had much choice under the circumstances but to disperse the funds in accordance with the instruction of a person who put the funds in my control. It was not a money laundering scheme. Money laundering means that you're trying to conceal money. This was not concealed. There were active negotiations going on at the time that this transaction took place.
Your position is that the trial court, if these were in fact insurance proceeds and they were her separate property, she had a right to put them in the Cayman Islands, and the trial court had no authority to order her to produce her separate property in the court.
Yes, in the absence of a substantive determination of breach of fiduciary duty and her personal liability, she was not a judgment creditor. There is no evidence in the record, although it's stated, there is no evidence in the record that her insurance proceeds were in some way part of this estate. And that was argued more fully. The only other point, I know my time is up, is that I wanted the court to be aware that we viewed some distinctions between this record and the January decision in Christensen versus Brzezelski, in that we're dealing with an order...
Well, I don't think we have time to go into a whole other point. We consider the whole case on it. But may I ask...
Yes, sir.
Please,
you respond within a few days of the brief that we expect from petitioner's counsel in a few days.
Yes, sir.
Concerning the, any effect of the amendment of the turnover statute on this case.
Yes, sir. I'm also unfamiliar with the amendment, and I will.
Thank you.
May I please the court, in response to the assertion by Mr. Ray that he was not the state's attorney at the time of the transfers, I think the record is fairly clear that he certainly was the state's attorney at the time of some of the transfers, maybe not the specific one that was asked about, but that it's clear he received $6,000 in fees as the state attorney, and that was deducted from the money that Mrs. Buller was asked to turn over. So he either took those fees under false pretenses that he was the state's attorney, or in fact he was the state's attorney at a time that these very transfers were going on. I think that the court has asked a lot of the evidentiary questions, and the sites are set out in my brief. I think Mr. Ray essentially agreed that I've cited them correctly, and the record states exactly as I said. There's a very telling passage at page 12 in the dissenting opinion that's quoted at length, where it is abundantly clear that the court is interested in the records about the Cayman Island funds, and I think you can infer from that 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 is one of the things that he had ordered her to bring at the January 7th hearing, although we don't have that order before us, because there is an objection by Mr. Ray that that's just trying to discover her personal assets. And he said, no, that's the information, that is the bank records, that we've been trying to get for months. And it is abundantly clear that if you in fact had bank records that showed that there was insurance proceeds that was directly traceable into that account and nothing else, that you would come forward with those records that would exonerate you. And the fact that she did not come forward with those records allows the trial court to draw the adverse inference. That is, the records would be harmful, and the records would show that this was a money laundering scheme and the money did go into the Cayman Islands. And so I think that we did directly trace it, although by circumstantial evidence and inference from the absence of records that she was ordered to produce and records that it is unbelievable that any person would not have in their possession, that is their bank account or an active 100,000 plus bank account that she would have in her records. So we rest our case not only on the tracing the property into the fiduciary's hands, although that was one of the theories in the trial court, but also on the fact that on this record and on the adverse inferences that can be drawn based on the facts that were proved, you can have a tracing into the Cayman Islands, assuming that you're allowed, based on the partial record, to go into the no evidence point at all. I think that is really the only responses that I have to Mr. Ray's presentation, unless there are additional questions. I'll give back the rest of my time to the court.
Any questions?
Thank you, counsel.
I appreciate it.
The court will take another brief recess.
The audience will be quiet.